Hello and welcome to Career 24. It's Thursday, the 13th of May, and I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The National Assembly speakers called for a plenary session to take place this evening to vote on the appointment of Prime Minister nominee Kim Buk-yeom. This comes as the controversial nominee for Oceans Minister announced he was stepping down over the British porcelain scandal. We'll have the latest on the political wrangling over the cabinet reshuffle in our news briefing shortly. For our in-depth, we take a look at what lessons South Korea can learn from Israel's Iron Dome air defense system that seems to have successfully protected most of the nation in its escalating conflict with Hamas. Plus, on Explore Korea, we'll be looking at the Busan Arts Fair taking place this week. Let's begin Career 24. The Speaker of the National Assembly has called for a plenary session to vote on the appointment of Prime Minister nominee Kim Buk-yeom this Thursday evening. This follows the resignation of President Moon Jae-in's nominee for Oceans Minister earlier on Thursday amid public anger over a British porcelain scandal involving his wife. Joining us now in the studio to elaborate on the political strife and other news of the day is KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Chang-woo.
So Oceans and Fisheries Minister nominee Park Jun-young was the first to cave to public uproar and the demands from the opposition to step down, with the future of the remaining two cabinet member nominees still up in the air.
Indeed. Park issued a statement on Thursday saying he would step down as a nominee, apologising for his wife's controversial purchases of thousands of high-end British teacups and porcelain pieces, which he and his wife allegedly brought to Korea without paying due taxes. Park's wife shipped her collection among their belongings, which were not required to clear customs as they were returning to South Korea after Park's tenure as a diplomat in London in 2018, allowing her to avoid paying customs duties. She then posted pictures of her collection on social media and sold them online and at her cafe that she opened after their return. Park stated he won't burden the president or the Oceans Ministry any longer, noting that he had failed to meet the public's exacting standards for a cabinet minister. Park is one of three ministerial nominees who, according to the opposition, did not pass muster due to ethical lapses.
So what has been the response from the ruling and opposition factions then?
Well, the ruling Democratic Party is calling on the opposition to endorse the confirmation of the two remaining candidates, Science Minister nominee Im Hae-suk and Land Minister nominee No Young-wook. The presidential office said that it hoped Park's resignation will lead to their prompt appointments. A main opposition People Power Party spokesperson, Pae Jun-young, welcomed Park's resignation. Still, he maintained that both Lim and Noor were as bad, if not worse, than Park, and continued to call on for their resignation as well. Earlier today, the two factions met to try and reach a compromise on these issues, but talks fell through.
Right, despite the Oceans Minister nominee stepping down, the appointments of ministers are not subject to approval by the National Assembly, but the appointment of the Prime Minister nominee Kim Buk-yeom is. So that has to be approved by Parliament. As I mentioned, the Speaker has called for a plenary session this evening to vote on his appointment. We'll see how that goes. We'll have the results perhaps of that session later in the show or in tomorrow's episode. Let's continue on now and turn to the world of business. South Korea announced a $451 billion plan to establish the world's largest semiconductor supply chain over the next 10 years amid a global chip shortage. Can you tell us more?
Yes, South Korea unveiled a 10-year project in which chip makers such as Samsung and SK Hynix will invest 510 trillion won, and the government will provide tax cuts and cheap loans to reciprocate. The announcement to create a so-called K-semiconductor belt by 2030 came after a meeting held at Samsung Electronics on Thursday with President Moon Jae-in among its participants. Moon said that the government plans to join hands with the private sector to solidify its position as the world's largest memory chip maker and even make forays into the non-memory chip sector, becoming the world leader in the semiconductor industry by 2030. World-leading companies such as Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix set aside 41.8 8 trillion won for this year alone to launch the project to establish an infrastructure for semiconductor production, materials, parts and equipment, cutting-edge devices and fabless manufacturing in Pangyo and Yongin in the provincial area of Gyeonggi. The government will provide a tax deduction of up to 50% for research and development and up to 20% for facilities investment from the second half of this year until 2024.
Let's move on to the diplomatic front now. Local courts have reportedly assessed the domestic asset value of Nippon Steel in the continuation of a compensation suit against it for forced labour during World War II. Can you elaborate on this for us?
Yes, the Daegu District Court said on Thursday that its supporting office in Pohang conducted an asset evaluation of PNR, the South Korea-based affiliate of Nippon Steel. However, sources say the timing for the sell-off order is as yet undecided. In October 2018, South Korea's Supreme Court ordered Nippon Steel to pay four victims of forced labour that filed the suit 100 million won each in compensation. When Nippon Steel failed to comply with that order, the regional court in 2019 authorized the seizure of PNR stock assets estimated at more than 400 million won. Last year, the court handed down a ruling to seize Nippon assets in South Korea to compensate the victims. Japan has repeatedly protested the move. Meanwhile, South Korea's spy chief Park Ji-won reportedly met with Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on Wednesday and conveyed Seoul's hope to normalize ties between the two nations. According to the diplomatic source familiar with Seoul-Tokyo relations on Thursday, Park reportedly told Prime Minister Suga that the current state of Seoul-Tokyo relations is not desirable, stressing the need and intent to normalize ties.
Yes, and Park was in Tokyo on Wednesday for a trilateral meeting with his US and Japanese counterparts to discuss issues related to North Korea and China. And the US official in that meeting is now here in South Korea and on Thursday visited the demilitarized zone that separates the two Koreas.
Indeed. While details of her itinerary were not released, Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines arrived in South Korea and headed to the DMZ, where she most likely toured the joint security area at the Truce Village of Panmunjom. Haines met with key military intelligence officials and was also planning to pay a courtesy call on President Moon Jae-in and hold talks with National Security Advisor Seo-hun, where they will likely discuss the U.S.-North Korea policy.
Now, a state-run think tank revised up its growth forecast for the South Korean economy this year based on expectations that exports will significantly improve. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the Korea Development Institute said on Thursday that it expects the economy to expand 3.8% this year, up 0.7 percentage points from its November forecast. The think tank predicted the economy to grow 3% in 2022. KDI said even with the upward revision, the economy will still come short of the previous target, with an average growth of 1.9% between 2020 and 2022. The think tank forecasts the nation's exports to rise by 8.6% this year on the back of a surge in demand for semiconductors, automobiles, petroleum goods, in line with the outlook for a faster than expected global economic recovery.
And finally, the latest news on the pandemic here in South Korea. South Korea saw the number of new daily infections jump up to the 700s, marking a two-week high. So a concerning jump up in infections then, Heejin.
Indeed. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 715 new infections on Thursday, bringing the country's cumulative total to 129,633. A solid two-thirds of those infected still came from Seoul and the greater metro area, fueling concerns of a continued spike in clusters and in the densely populated cities.
That's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Coming up next is in-depth news analysis. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The conflict between Israel and Hamas escalated this week, with the two sides trading airstrikes and rocket fire, leaving scores dead. One aspect of the fighting that has caught particular attention, especially here in South Korea, is how Israel's air defense capabilities have held up. The sounds you're hearing now are from remarkable footage of the Iron Dome air defense interceptors shooting down hundreds of rockets as they rained down on central Israel on Tuesday evening. Various videos captured by those in Tel Aviv on their smartphones have been doing the rounds online, and the Israeli Defense Forces have released a video clip as well. Officials claim the system has proven to be more than 90% effective. In South Korea, this has led to questions about its own air defense capabilities, as the nation also remains under the threat of rockets and missiles from North Korea. To address these questions, we have invited two experts to join us on the line today. First, we have Ankit Panda, who is the Stanton Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, and he's also an expert on Korean Peninsula issues and on missile defense. Mr. Panda, thank you for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure for being here. Thank you for having me.
And we also have retired Lieutenant General Tanimbum on the line, a good friend of the show. He is a former Special Ops Commander as well as Deputy Commander of the 1st ROK Army. Welcome back on the show, General.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And Mr. Panda, I believe you have seen footage of the interceptions made by the Iron Dome system. It was quite incredible to see, and they seem to have been very effective, as interceptors are said to have shot down most of the 130 rockets launched by Hamas militants. What was your evaluation of the system and its effectiveness this week?
So it's difficult to derive the effectiveness of Iron Dome based on the information that's released so far. But in general, yes, Iron Dome is effective at doing what it does, which is primarily intercepting these unguided rockets that fly entirely within the Earth's atmosphere. I think that's important to emphasize that these rockets that are being used by Hamas militants are unsophisticated short-range systems. Iron Dome also has some very sophisticated software integration that allows it to avoid intercepting any rockets that are simply going to land in uninhabited areas. So it does do some prioritization and calculation to actually target and intercept the rockets that are most likely to cause damage to civilian populated areas.
General Chan, same question to you. What have you made of the Iron Dome system from what we've seen in recent days? And how do you compare it to the PAC-3 system that the U.S. delivered to South Korea late last year, as well as other advanced interceptors?
Yeah, so 90% might be debatable, but Iron Dome is an effective and proven system. Now, having said that, it would be unfair to compare it with the PAC-3 Patriot missile because the two are different. For example, Israel operates the Arrow missile system for targets that are at 50-kilometer range, which is high altitude, and the David Sling missile system for mid-altitude targets, and the Iron Dome for targets below 10 kilometers in altitude. So the PAC-3 is equivalent to the Israeli David Sling. As of now, we have no system like the Iron Dome in Korea. Mm. The reason for this was because Korea faces a North Korea that has the ability to shoot between 5 to even 15,000 artillery, rockets, and missiles into South Korea per hour. And it was felt that we could never field enough defensive systems to defend all of Seoul. It seems it was not a correct decision, and South Korea announced it would develop a Iron Dome-like system by 2030.
Right. People here in Korea, including myself, were surprised about the barrage of rockets that was seen in the footage, the sheer quantity of the rockets. So, General Chan, how does it compare, as you said, to the missile and rocket threats that South Korea faces? So you're saying what we saw in the Israeli video footage, it cannot be compared to perhaps the threat that North Korea were to pose if it were to fire rockets at South Korea?
Yeah, so initially, I think we can assume that we will see a lot more, not only rockets, but missiles and artillery coming into the Seoul area. But the Iron Dome missile system concept is not to defend the entire city, but to defend critical infrastructure assets, such as our airfields, hospitals, electricity, and water. And by doing that, we will be able to function as a city as well as a nation. So if you think of it in that concept, no matter what the challenge quantity or size might be, you can see that we would need some sort of system that would guarantee the defense of these critical infrastructures that I just mentioned.
Mr. Panda, what about yourself? What is your assessment of North Korea's rocket and short-range missile capabilities in terms of quantity and weapon strength? You describe the Hamas missiles as unsophisticated and short-range. Would it be different here in North Korea North Korea?
So, yes, just to echo everything that General Chun just said, it's absolutely a different type of threat. Another thing I think to emphasize in the context of the threat that Israel faces is that deterrence in the between Israel and Hamas fails regularly, right? Rocket launches, of course, not at the intensity we've just seen in the last 24 to 36 hours, but otherwise rocket threats to the Israeli population are a regular occurrence, whereas on the Korean Peninsula, with the exception of a deterrence failure like what happened in 2010 with the sinking of the Cheonan and the shelling of Yeongbyungdo, thankfully, deterrence has not failed in a way that has resulted in North Korea launching artillery or rockets at Seoul. If deterrence were to fail on the Korean Peninsula, we would likely see a major conflict that would likely result in escalation to the level of a complete war and all-out conflict between the two countries. That said, the concept that General Chun described is important. The fact that in a conflict, North Korea would primarily rely on many longer-range missile systems, right? Many of the systems that it has recently been testing, and even going back to the early 2000s, are 300-millimeter, 240-millimeter rockets, and these are on the smaller side of what North Korea would use to strike at targets to Seoul further down, whereas in the case of Hamas, we're talking a much smaller diameter of rockets flying at much lower altitudes. Just to give you an example, many of these rocket systems go all the way down to just 100, 107 millimeters. So the kinds of threats are different. The concepts when it comes to deterrence and the expectation of deterrence failure is different. So it does need to be, I think, clearly stated that these kinds of differences do need to weigh on decision-making in South Korea when it comes to the viability of these kinds of systems and their cost effectiveness overall. That's another important aspect here, is what we're seeing Hamas doing right now in the last 24 hours is really testing Iron Dome's limits, because these missile defense systems, any missile defense system, will always have a finite magazine depth, and operators will need to reload these systems when the intensity of launches is as high as it has been. This creates complications, and of course, I think Hamas is trying to exploit that and see where Israel's limits really do lie.
With everything that you've said in mind then, Mr. Panda, what's your assessment of South Korea's air defense capabilities currently?
So South Korea is, of course, undertaking indigenous air defense efforts, including the LSAM and the MSAM, and procuring U.S.-made systems. Like General Chun said, these are primarily focused on higher-level threats, including short-range ballistic missiles, guided GPS-guided rocket artillery systems, which not only have a longer range but could potentially carry WMD payloads in certain circumstances. We, of course, heard Kim Jong-un earlier this year at the Eight-Party Congress begin to talk about tactical nuclear weapons. I'll just remind listeners that Pakistan, another nuclear state, operates a tactical nuclear rocket that is mated to a 300-millimeter rocket artillery system, which in the North Korean case would be analogous to the system known as the KN-09. So North Korea could potentially develop a nuclear-capable system like that. So these threats, I think, again, need to be emphasized. So while South Korea's missile defense capabilities are, of course, marching forward, the problem is the cost exchange ratio when it comes to missile defense almost universally favors the attacker. That even given the vast differential between the economy of the two Koreas and South Korea's ability, especially in its recent intermediate term national defense program, to outlay billions and billions of won on missile defense, among other things, North Korea can simply spend far less developing
more and more ballistic missiles to saturate and keep ahead of South Korea's missile defense capabilities.
General Chun, that sounds rather concerning for South Korea. Can South Korea intercept most, if not all, North Korean rockets currently? What about the Korean Air and Missile Defense, or KAMD, system that South Korea is currently developing?
Okay. No, we will not be able to shoot down every North Korean missile. The KAMD is an acronym for the Korea Air Missile Defense. It is a part of our strategy to defend against incoming missiles. For every North Korean missile that is fired on South Korea, we would have to shoot maybe two or more missiles against it. South Korea is going to need a lot of missiles, and that is why KAMD is only a part of our defense strategy. KAMD is also a layered defense. For high altitude, we have THAAD. For mid-altitude, we have the PAC-3 and the Korean-made LSAMs. No system for low-altitude interception. Another point to be made is that the Iron Dome type of system is beyond the concept of intercepting incoming missiles, which is what the KAMD has been focusing on. Iron Dome is about protecting critical assets from not only aircraft and missiles, but from rockets, artillery, and even small caliber munitions. People need to understand this concept and why it is critically important.
Okay, so as much as the footage showing the Iron Dome in action in recent days has been doing the rounds online and has been catching the attention of people here in South Korea, General Chun, what lessons can South Korea then take from what we've seen from the Iron Dome, and what lessons should we be learning from it all?
Well, Iron Dome is not perfect, but I do believe that we need the Iron Dome, not just developing an Iron Dome type of system. And I say this because I was once one of those who thought that the Iron Dome was too expensive and could not protect the whole of the Korean people. Now I'm a little bit wiser, and although South Korea is attempting to have an operational system by 2030, that is 9 years away at best. Iron Dome is right here, and it's here now. Either Korea accelerates its timeline, or they should purchase Iron Dome to protect critical infrastructure from external threat. Now, Iron Dome is not going to solve all our problems. We need air raid shelters, and the populations needs to train. Otherwise, Iron Dome is, or anything like it, is not going to solve our problems. So we're going to need a lot more on this issue.
Mr. Panda, what do you think? Do you think South Korea should perhaps be looking into purchasing the Iron Dome system? And what should South Korea be thinking about in terms of air defense capabilities currently?
So, absolutely. I mean, I think my perspective is a little different from General Chun here. I mean, of course, every country, not just South Korea, has to reason about defense procurement and spending under resource constraints. South Korea does not have an unlimited amount of won to spend on defensive technologies. And like I said earlier, the blessing, of course, that South Korea has had is that we have not seen a major and complete failure of deterrence with North Korea since the end of the Korean War in 1953, which is very different from the situation that Israel faces. The motivation for Israel to procure Iron Dome and set it up was ultimately to create a society where civilians would feel like the threat that looms in Gaza, where Hamas militants operate these rockets, would not necessarily affect everyday life. And of course, I think over the last 24 hours, we've seen even with Iron Dome, normal civilian life in Israel has unfortunately been quite disrupted. So with South Korea, ultimately, I think given North Korea's higher end capabilities and the real possibility of escalation on the Korean Peninsula to the nuclear level, the ongoing investments in Korea in KAMD and on procuring U.S.-made systems and, of course, the United States THAAD battery. These kinds of higher-level missile defense capabilities, I do think, bring quite a bit of value, because ultimately in a conflict, these will limit damage in from North Korea's most devastating capabilities. That said, I do think that the notion of protecting airstrips, hospitals, critical infrastructure with a limited amount of low-altitude endo-atmospheric missile defense systems like Iron Dome can make good sense if it does preserve the ability for South Korea to maintain the ability to operate as a society in the context of anything short of a limited and total conflict with North Korea.
Well, what we've seen of the Iron Dome has certainly given South Korea a lot to think about. But first and foremost, of course, our thoughts go out to those in Israel and Palestine as the fighting continues to escalate with seemingly no end in sight. We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Mr. Ankit Panda from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and retired Lieutenant General Chun Imbom. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 39.55 points, or 1.25% on Thursday, to close at 3,122.11. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 15.33 points, or 1.59%, to close at 951.77. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 4.61 against the dollar, ending the session at 1,129.31. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our daily segment, Korea Trending. Here, our Korea 24 team has picked out some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And to tell us about those stories is Lee Joo-young, who joins us on the line now. Joo-young, hello.
Hello, Jung-won.
So what do you have for us today?
We'll first talk about how someone made the shocking discovery of a rubber glove inside a bag of frozen dumplings. We then talk about the passing of Peter Bartholomew, also known as the Guardian of Hanok. Our last story is about BTS collaborating with one of the world's largest fast food companies.
Okay, let's get started on our first story then. And it's about something unexpected that was found in a bag of frozen food. Can you tell us more?
Sure. A rubber glove was found in a frozen dumpling product produced by a major South Korean food company, CJ Cheuldeoreum. According to a local report yesterday, a consumer who found the rubber glove reported the incident to the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety along with a picture. The photo shows a used rubber glove inside a dumpling bag with the name of the worker who used the glove at the time of production written on it.
Oh dear. And when we say rubber glove, we mean like a big one, like one you might use in your kitchen. So
yes.
Do we know how the glove ended up in the bag of frozen dumplings?
Well, food safety authorities believe that the worker placed the glove on top of a manufacturing machinery and it accidentally slipped in without his or her knowing. The incident is estimated to have occurred around December last year. And authorities have issued corrective orders to CJ to prevent the incident from happening again.
Right. Imagine being the customer who finds this glove, but also imagine being the worker who let it happen, especially, as we said, their name was written
exactly.
on the glove as well. A mm-hmm. nightmare day at work. Have we heard anything from the company on this matter?
Yes. The company acknowledged that it was due to carelessness and poor management of staff. And they explained that the glove failed to be discovered and removed as it was not detected on their x-ray test before shipment. Also, the weight of the glove was similar to a single dumpling, so they did not think to go back and check it. The food company said that it has now taken measures to use gloves that can be detected on the spot to prevent the matter from reoccurring.
Right, well, thankfully it wasn't anything more unsanitary than a rubber glove, but it's good to know that they have responded swiftly. Extraordinary. Let's move on to our second story. Now, what do you have for us?
Peter Bartholomew, who is also known as the guardian of Korea's traditional styled houses, Hanok, passed away at the age of 76 yesterday. He died at his Hanok home in Dongseomundong in Seoul. Bartholomew had received an honorary citizenship award from the mayor of Seoul in 2010, and in 2012, he received a prestigious award from the Ministry of Culture, Sports, and Tourism for his contributions in promoting and protecting the value of Hanok. He was the first foreigner to receive the award.
So this moniker, Guardian of Hanok, it's very striking. How did Bartholomew become known by this name?
He played a big part in protecting Hanoks that were in danger of being destroyed. So in 2004, 43 Hanoks in the Dongseomundong area where Bartholomew resided were on the verge of being demolished as it had been designated as a housing redevelopment area. However, Bartholomew, along with 19 other residents, filed a lawsuit against the Seoul government to revoke the designation of the maintenance zone, citing the need to preserve traditional houses. They won the case. And ever since then, Bartholomew has been dubbed the Hanok Guardian.
I see. Seems like a fitting name. I'm sure many listeners are still curious about his journey to South Korea as well and how he came to be acquainted with Korea's traditional houses. Can you tell us a bit more about his background?
Sure. Bartholomew was born in the U.S. and he first visited Korea as a member of the Peace Corps in 1968 at 23 years old. The first house that he resided in was a Hanok that was passed down from the Joseon Dynasty at Gangwon Province, east of Seoul. He subsequently moved his residence to Seoul in 1973 and briefly stayed in an apartment, but moved out in less than a year to another Hanok in Dongseomundong that he bought and renovated. And he lived there for 47 years until his passing. Though his home is almost 100 years old, it is reportedly still in good condition and well preserved. And the funeral of Bartholomew, who lived alone without family, is being prepared by his friends and acquaintances.
Yes, it's a sad loss to the community here, but hopefully his legacy will remain in the Hanoks he has saved. Let's move on to our last story now, and it's related to BTS, Juyoung. It's been a while since we talked about the boys, but it looks like they've been busy.
Yes. America's largest fast food company, McDonald's, will join hands with K-pop phenomenon BTS to launch the so-called BTS meal across 49 countries on 6 continents. The BTS menu will only be sold between May 26th to June 20th, but people here in Korea will have to wait a little bit longer as it'll go on sale on the 27th. Experts analyze that the fast food chain joined hands with BTS to boost their global sales, which has been sluggish due to the coronavirus pandemic.
Right. I understand this is one of the biggest commercial partnerships with a K-pop group ever. Yeah. So it's pretty exciting, especially as people really get to see BTS's mark on their meals then.
That's right. And what's interesting about this collaboration is that consumers will be able to see the Korean alphabet Hangul printed on their meals. In fact, the dipping sauce wrappers, sauces that were actually developed in Korea, are written in Korean. Also, uniforms that employees will wear during the event period are also attracting attention as they'll feature the BTS logo and the Korean consonants of BTS.
Right, so a really extensive collaboration. Is this something that the fast food chain has done before?
Yes, but not at this level. The company partnered with singer J Balvin and rapper Travis Scott for a similar event that only happened within the U.S. The collaboration with BTS is on a different scale, though, as the menu will be launched at their stores around the world.
Yes, as you said, 49 countries will be featured in. I understand it would have been even more countries in Europe if the delayed Euro Football Championships hadn't been taking place this year, as that deal takes priority. So it's a shame, as it could have been even bigger, but this is still a very impressive deal for the boys indeed. That is, well, we'll wrap it up for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Juyoung, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you.
We've once again come to our Thursday corner, Explore Korea, where we learn about some of the cultural, historical and travel highlights that Korea has to offer. And this week we're joined on the line by our arts critic Andy St. Louis, who is the founder of Seoul Art Friend, an online platform dedicated to all things Korean contemporary art. Andy, it's great to speak to you again.
Likewise, Jang-ho.
So what are we discussing this week, Andy?
Well, we're actually taking a trip down south to the city of Busan.
where the 10th edition of Art Busan is being held this weekend. And along the way, we'll also preview several art exhibitions on view across the city of Busan that are worth a visit.
Okay, we've often talked about exhibitions and galleries that are available to view here in Seoul, so it's great to learn about what else is out there in Korea. What can you tell us about the contemporary art scene in Busan?
So as the second largest city in the country, Busan supports quite a healthy contemporary art ecosystem, with several important art spaces that have garnered critical acclaim. So much of the local art scene is actually clustered in the eastern sector of the city, nearby Haeyun Bay Beach. And it's also where Art Busan, the city's premier annual art fair, takes place this weekend.
Right, and I understand Art Busan has really raised its profile in recent years by inviting more and more galleries from the US and Europe. How does Art Busan stack up against other art fairs in Korea?
It's probably the second most important fair in the country, with KIAF, which stands for Korea International Art Fair. KIAF usually takes the top spot. Since it's just been launched around 10 years ago, Art Busan is still a relative newcomer to the domestic art fair scene, whereas KIAF celebrates its 20th edition this year. However, Art Busan exudes a really vibrant energy and powerful sort of excitement, more than the relatively old-school KIAF. And I predict that it won't be long before Art Busan develops into a true competitor with KIAF.
I see. And is this year's event just as exciting then? What can visitors expect from Art Busan this year?
So starting tomorrow, over 100 galleries will present booths at BEXCO, which is the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center. And these galleries include major Seoul commercial galleries like Kukje, Hyundai, PKM, Arario, and Ghana, as well as some important regional galleries like Lian and Usan from Daegu, Johyan and Lian Bay from Busan, and even some up-and-coming galleries like Whistle, ERD, Doing Art, and Kiche.
Right, so a wide variety of galleries from all over Korea. What about galleries from overseas?
Well, despite the challenges of negotiating COVID restrictions and quarantine protocols, there's actually quite a respectable contingent of Western galleries coming to this year's fair, including Esther Schipper and Perez Projects, both from Berlin, Thaddeus Ropak and Pilar Corrias, both from London, and Beck Art and Commonwealth and Council, which are originally from Los Angeles. Now, a must-see for visitors this year is a special presentation by Icelandic artist Ólafur Eliasson, who is showing this very seminal, famous light installation that was a crowd favorite at the artist's 2019 retrospective exhibition at the Tate Modern in London.
Right, so even amid the pandemic, they've managed the logistics to get these exciting foreign galleries to participate, and it looks like it's going to be a great event. Art Busan is taking place at BEXCO on May 14th to 16th. For more information, our listeners can visit artbusankorea.com. And for those who cannot make it to Busan this weekend as well, there is an online viewing room available on the fair's website where you can check out all the works on offer. Now, Andy, that is the main event we're talking about today, but you also said you would be introducing us to some other exhibitions that people can visit around the city of Busan currently.
Yeah, I thought, why not? If you're going to be going down to Busan, try to see as much art as you can. And a great place to start is actually right across the street from BEXCO. It's the Busan Museum of Art. And they're currently holding several exhibitions, but the one I'm most excited about is titled The Nature of Art, and it's a group exhibition that looks to nature as a source of healing and consolation amid the difficulties of the COVID era. So the show includes installations by Hae-soo Park and Kang Tae-hoon, photos by Hyung-geun Park, videos by Ji-hae-young and Guido van der Verve, and even some 3D digital animations by David Clairbout and A. Strict. I'm looking forward to exploring the kind of, you know, heartfelt as well as hopeful perspectives of this group of artists, both from Korea and abroad, in the context of the sort of pervasive feelings of isolation that we've all sort of succumbed to over this past year or so.
Indeed. So this is on at the Busan Museum of Art. It's called The Nature of Art, and it's on view through September 12th. I understand that there is another exhibition over at the Museum of Contemporary Art, where the relationship between art and nature is also the focus.
That's right. So Mocha Busan, which is actually a relatively new art space in the city, they opened an expansive exhibition titled Sustainable Museum, Art, and Environment, which looks at nature in slightly a different way than the show at Busan Museum. This exhibition examines the ways that artists and museums can decrease their carbon footprint and pursue more ecologically friendly practices. So this exhibition will include an array of Korean and international artists, plus contributions from contemporary art museums throughout the Asian region, and even some Korean logistics companies who are responsible for domestic art transport. All of these parties are proposing tactics and actions that offer alternatives to the current resource-intensive methodologies of producing art in exhibitions. So the exhibition here at Mocha Busan really promises to be a thought-provoking experience, and I can't wait to see how the curators have presented some of their own experiments in sustainable exhibition design.
Right, it sounds like a really interesting and timely exhibition for the industry. It's called Sustainable Museum, and it's on at Mocha Busan through September 22nd. Before you finish up, I know there are a couple of other exhibition highlights at commercial galleries in Busan that you wanted to flag up, Andy. What do you recommend?
Well, Joyeon Gallery, which is sort of the leading gallery based in Busan, they're presenting an exhibition of art furniture by Choi Byung-hoon, who is widely considered the father of Korean contemporary design. His exhibition is titled Seat of Silence, and it features new works made of basalt stone, which the artist grinds away at for up to 2 months at a time in order to create textural juxtapositions between the rough, raw state of the stone and the gleaming softness of its polished interior. Now, Choi's minimal aesthetic allows the materiality of each piece to really connect with viewers, and this exhibition is certain to be a hit among audiences in town this weekend for Art Busan. And finally, the Busan outpost of Kukje Gallery, based in Seoul, is presenting an exhibition by conceptual artist An Kyu-chul titled The Other Side of Things. And this show offers a survey of An's three-decade-long career, including everyday objects that often go unnoticed, thus confronting the irrationalities and paradoxes of modern life. It's sort of an interesting attempt by the artist to measure whether these objects remain relevant today and continue to resonate with contemporary audiences while exploring how our collective awareness and perception of art can change over time. So for anyone unfamiliar with An's practice, this exhibition provides an excellent introduction to his distinctive artistic approach.
Okay, so Choi Byung-hoon's exhibition is on at the Joyeon Gallery through July 4th, and An Kyu-chul's exhibition is on at the Kukje Gallery, and that's also on view through to July 4th. Well, Andy, thank you for providing us with a thorough guide of everything that we can check out in Busan. It sounds like a great excuse for a weekend away from Seoul for our art lovers out there. I think we'll be putting up some details and pictures on our Instagram page as well, KBS_Korea24. So do check that out as well for more information. Andy, it's been a pleasure as always. Take care and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you. Talk to you next time.
This is Swiss flutist Philipp Jund. I am professor of flute at Neuchâtel Conservatory in Switzerland and at Gangnam University in Korea. You are listening to Korea 24.
We finish up with our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers. And our thanks goes out to the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who kindly provide us with their early editions to make this segment possible. Joining me now is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who's been looking through those papers for us. Mark, hello.
Hello, good to see you.
So what stories do you have for us today?
We are headed to the People's section of the Korea Times, where Park Eun-ji has a very sweet story about Jang Ok-soon, who just passed an exam, which is the equivalent of getting a high school diploma at 84 years of age.
Wow.
Jang is in fact the oldest person to achieve the feat in the country. She graduated in middle school in 2017 and applied 6 times for the high school equivalency diploma and finally passed. Now, Jang was born in Uiseong, North Gyeongsang Province, and like many children at the time, her educational path was blocked by financial difficulties. She entered elementary school during the Japanese colonial period and couldn't graduate until the Korean War. She told the Times that she always wanted to study, but when her husband died 30 years ago, she had to focus on raising her 2 sons, who, by the way, went to university, who were most definitely pushed by their mother to do so.
Right, yeah. I see. I could imagine. That is amazing. 84 years old and passing a high school diploma. It shows you could never be too old to continue to learn.
That's right.
So what's next for this fresh high school graduate?
College. Well, she says if she were 14 years younger at the ripe age of 70, she'd enter with no worries at all, okay? But she's just wondering how her health and energy would hold up considering her age.
Wow, so not only has she got a high school diploma, she wants to go to college as well.
Why
and
not?
Get a college degree.
You know?
That is amazing at 84 years old.
It's lovely.
Yes, it's a great heartwarming story that you brought for us. Mm-hmm. And our support goes out for her. We hope she does make it and get her college degree as well.
That's right.
Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
This next piece can be found in the Korea Herald's Weekender section, where Im Min-byul writes about construction and architecture going green for the benefit of the environment as well as our health. In fact, there's a standard that needs to be met before a construction project can even take off, called the Green Standard for Energy and Environmental Design, also known as GSEED. But the thing is, going green costs money. An official of a major construction company told the Herald that environmentally friendly materials, that's great, but it costs a lot. Mm. And if you're familiar with how a builder works, their job is to save costs in construction to maximize profit.
Right, and cutting costs as much as you can, as you said, is part of what these people do, which is unfortunate and can lead to some unfortunate side effects as well. But yes, it's important to make our buildings more green nowadays. How then builders are finding ways to do this, but at the same time, make it affordable?
Well, Im writes about the Green Roof Project that actually has been around since 2002 that converts building roofs to green gardens. This is much cheaper than buying environmentally friendly materials, say like insulation, that can cost millions of dollars. That also has to be environmentally friendly. And in February, the Seoul Metropolitan Government said it would also support the project. Now, here's where things get cool, both figuratively and literally. According to the SMG, the average temperature of buildings with rooftop gardens dropped around 3 degrees Celsius. But then, air conditioning and heat energy consumption for these buildings went down by 12 to 15% on average. And because these buildings are cooler, that reduces the urban heat island effect. That's when urban areas are warmer than the surrounding areas, I'm sure many people know. So these affordable green roofs are actually reducing energy and cooling cities at the same time. It's amazing.
Wow, it's such a simple idea, putting
so cool.
a garden on a roof, and that has such an effect. And not only does it make the buildings cooler, I guess, but it also provides fresh air to the surrounding area as well. Sounds great. That's an interesting report to check out in tomorrow's Korea Herald. That is where we leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that is where we leave it for our show today. Tomorrow we have our Friday edition of the show, so that means Professor Yang Jun-suk will be joining us to break down some of the week's biggest economy stories, as well as our panel of film critics for Movie Spotlight. We'll also, of course, have our daily news updates as well, so do join us again then. Till then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
Chen, Chen Sang-byung.
Back to Heaven by Chen Sang-byung.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 새벽빛 와 닿으면 쓰러지는 이슬 더불어 손에 손을 잡고.
I'll go back to Heaven again. Hand in hand with the dew that melts at a touch of the dawning day.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 노을빛 함께 단 둘이서 기슭에서 놀다가 구름 손짓하면은
I'll go back to heaven again with the dusk together just we two at a sign from a cloud after playing on the slopes
나 하늘로 돌아가리라 아름다운 이 세상 소풍 끝내는 날 가서 아름다웠더라고 말하리라
I'll go back to heaven again at the end of my outing to this beautiful world I'll go back and say that was beautiful
You've listened to Korean poet Chun Sang-byung's Gui Chan, Back to Heaven, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Taiz and Sun Jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world.